This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health, and today there's a focus on the people who deliver your health care. So, first, the good news. The doctor shortage has eased somewhat in the last 3 years, and this according to a new study that found that more Canadians have a primary care physician or nurse practitioners than they did back in 2022. The bad news, well, nearly 6 million of us still do not have a primary care person. Meantime, the government has set up a new category of immigration for foreign-trained doctors, a fast track for them to get in and work here. Now, it's for foreign-trained doctors who have worked here for at least a year. So I'm wondering, is this a move to snag some of the excellent fellows who are in this country doing advanced learning and also providing treatment? I'm sure the docs will be able to enlighten me on that one. And the last time this came up and there were complaints, what people said was that the restrictions on this were meant to help Canadian doctors who studied abroad but then couldn't find places here. So what about those doctors? So also, as predicted, this flu season is much worse than last year. And also, there is a new pill to treat postpartum depression.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'm joined by Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist with the Princess Margaret Cancer Center and former head of BC Cancer. Dr. Amal Verma, a staff physician in general internal medicine at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. And Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Hi, Libby.
Okay, let us begin with something that we've talked about a lot before, and that is this whole move where sometimes politicians point to foreign-trained doctors as the answer to our problems. So, Malcolm, this new category, is it intended to snag those fellows who are already in the country? Malcolm? Okay, Malcolm is probably on mute. Let's go to Dr. Verma. Hi.
Hi, Libby. I think it's, honestly, we have a huge capacity challenge in terms of enhancing access to healthcare in our country. And so no one solution is like going to solve all of these problems. This feels like a meaningful step towards getting more qualified physicians into our system. And your specific question of whether, you know, fellows that are here, so sort of in their advanced later stages of training, doing some specialized fellowship here, might they be retained by a measure like this, which fast tracks access to permanent residency? I think the answer is yes. So I'll give you an example. My hospital has a fellowship in general internal medicine, which many people come. They do a year of training here, additional training. Based at St. Michael's Hospital, they have a foreign credential, and then they need a number of steps. They need not only access to permanent residency, which the federal government has some levers over, but they also need a pathway to licensure, right? And that's really important. And so it's important that we see coordination at the federal, provincial, and the colleges levels to ensure that we can provide access to people. But, you know, once those trainees go through a year of experience at our hospital, most of them are fantastic physicians who would be, really great additions to our clinical care in this country. So I really like that there's that sort of 1 year requirement of work experience here. And I think it's a positive step, but you know, does need coordination across the system.
I'll tell you my own experience with that is when I was treated for my stomach cancer, which was kind of 2023, I saw a lot of fellows. You would always see the fellow before seeing the main doctor. And the main fellow who worked with my oncologist, whom I saw many times, and he was great. And all of these people are generally great because I was treated at UHN, and there's big competition around the world to get these spots. And then I recently learned that he got a job as a full-fledged oncologist in Halifax, where I'm sure they need him, which I think is probably a very good outcome for Canada because, again, I've seen quite a number of these fellows, and they were great doctors.
Yeah, totally agree, Libby. I think it's a great opportunity. I think it's important there to say just, you know, I'm sure obtaining permanent residency is just one of the hurdles. And so it's important that we clear these pathways to make it efficient for such excellent qualified people to join our healthcare systems.
Okay, well, efficiency is not something we have a big handle on. Do we have Malcolm on the mic yet?
Can you hear me, Libby?
Yes, now I can hear you. So we've been talking about this new move to fast track foreign doctors, and I was thinking, well, if it's intended to retrain all those excellent fellows who are here getting advanced learning, maybe it's good. But we've also talked about how poaching doctors is perhaps not the answer to our problems.
Well, in my opinion, it is not a good, it's not a great solution, but in the short term, we may have to do it. But I don't think pirating doctors from other jurisdictions, which are also short of doctors, is necessarily the way, particularly when there are so many talented Canadians who are trying to get into medical school, but can't get in because there's not enough places. So the longer term solution to me is let's just train more Canadians. Having said that, and from my experience in BC and when I was trying to recruit people at Princess Margaret, the big challenge with foreign doctors has been the licensing piece, not the immigration piece. And it's whether the training that they've had in whatever countries they come from is accredited in such a way that they can get a license. And that's always been the major roadblock as opposed to the immigration issues. So, And I think the colleges are doing this because they want to ensure that if someone is licensed to practice medicine in Canada, they're properly trained and capable to do that. So from my experience, the roadblock was always the college and getting this person accredited and their training accredited. And often what happens is that they have to do additional training in Canada or repeat some of their training in Canada before they can be licensed. So we'll sort of have to see how this goes.
I was wondering if this was sort of targeting fellows. I mean, when I was last treated for cancer at Princess Margaret, I saw a lot of fellows who were excellent doctors getting advanced training and who obviously had at least a year of experience here. Do you see this as a move to snag them? And I also told the story about one of them who recently found out, well, he got a job in Halifax as an oncologist.
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly at Princess Margaret, we have a lot of foreign fellows and they are excellent and from many different jurisdictions. So I think from a quality point of view, there's lots of good candidates. But again, it's still the issue of how do you get their training accredited by the college, because typically they don't want to redo some or all of their training before they're suitable for licensing. So, but I would say, yeah, that's the most interesting pool, if you like, is the people who are fully trained and are coming to Canada to do additional training because very capable people, as you discovered.
And the other question is, and the other thing that we talked about was Canadians who went to medical school elsewhere and really want to come back, but they can't get spots either.
Well, I think it's the same issue, which is the training that they're getting in these foreign medical schools, which are often honestly for-profit medical schools, is it sufficient to meet Canadian standards? I think that's the issue.
Okay. Moving on to Alisa. So as predicted, the flu season is worse than usual. And if I'm not mistaken, though, the take-up of the flu shot is not great.
So it's a bad year. And right now, as of last week's data, there is a 15.5% positivity within Toronto for influenza. So this number is quite high. This year it started early, so usually things are maybe slowly starting to take off now. People spend time with relatives and friends during the holiday period, and then usually it starts to get bad in a couple weeks. But we're right in the middle of it, and like I mentioned last week on the show, last Monday people started coming in being quite sick, and that has continued this week. More and more people are coming in who presumptively we assume that they have influenza, especially with the high positivity rate. And you're right, it's unfortunate that people haven't got the flu shot this year. I think it's about two messages. One is that people have been hesitant to get another vaccine. There's some people who never get the flu shot, and then people who are just don't want another shot. And that there was the earlier reports that this year it wasn't a good match. So I think people who might have been on the fence and who might have got it decided that there's no benefit in getting it. And let me just say that that's not true, that there's still a 30 to 40% effectiveness of getting the vaccine. And people still have an opportunity, and people should take that opportunity to get it. And the sooner that you get it, the better, because we're in the middle of it right now. And probably this week's numbers will be even worse than last week's.
Amo, what's going on in your emergency department?
Yeah, we're seeing it's an early surge to the flu season for sure, where it's tracking a little bit to the flu season a couple years ago, where we had an early surge. And I'm hopeful that like that flu season, we also had a bit of an early peak and things settled out. But we don't know. And as Alisa has pointed out, it does seem like this is trending towards a more severe flu season. So I think, you know, rightfully lots to be concerned about. I think leaning on our standard infection prevention measures really important here with, you know, hand hygiene when you go out. Some people who are higher risk or who are feeling unwell may choose to mask to try to reduce spread, or, you know, getting the flu in close contact situations. So I think all of that is an important part of these layers of protection, and the vaccine is really important. I'll just say, double down on what Alisa said, that first, so we have three flu strains that are circulating right now, and the vaccine has great coverage of two of them. And the third one, which is the one that is actually the most predominant, that H3N2 strain, which is out there, it's the one that tends to cause more severe flu. That's the one that doesn't have great coverage, but it still has some meaningful coverage. And so to Alisa's point, the early data out of the UK suggests a 30 to 40% effectiveness for adults, actually a 60 to 70% effectiveness in children. And so I think it's important that, you know, especially if it's a bad season, like let's acknowledge that that's still a really meaningful protection and really encourage people to go out and get those flu shots.
It's yeah, I know. Perhaps that wasn't the best message about the mismatch. Is there any way, Malcolm, for a person to know or to have an inkling about whether they've got the flu? I've heard about a lot of walking pneumonia. Or just a bad cold without getting a test?
The answer is no. There's so much overlap between the symptoms of the different respiratory viruses that you might have a sense of that it's one or the other, but you can't be sure. And I think there's no question that this is going to be a tough season. We're already starting to see some medical clinics, reintroduced more masking. I think we're going to see more masking. And, you know, a mask is a statement of health, not a statement of your politics. I think we should, if people are unwell, they should be wearing masks. And I would sort of say from my on the street conversations that the conversation I hear most commonly is somebody's sick with a respiratory virus. Some of them have been quite severe. And they'll say, and I got the flu shot, so what's the point? And I have heard that a lot this year, is that there are a lot of people sick and, you know, getting your shots, as we've discussed, doesn't fully guarantee you because there are so many different respiratory viruses.
Alisa, so there is now a pill that's been approved that's a treatment for postpartum depression. And I gather it's a certain kind of antidepressant.
That's right. So traditionally, we've been treating people with postpartum depression with an SSRI. But the problem with an SSRI, so common ones that people would know would be Zoloft or sertraline or Ciprolex, which is escitalopram, or even Prozac, which was the first one within the class, is that it takes a long time to work, and it works basically by increasing the amount of serotonin in your brain. This new drug is completely different. So this is working on, this is a breakdown product of progesterone that they have made this new drug that basically works on a different receptor within the brain. It works on the GABA receptor, and the GABA receptor, during pregnancy, progesterone, so people's level of the hormone progesterone becomes very high. And with delivery, that progesterone that somebody has been used to at this high level plummets and becomes very low. And they think because the progesterone, so this product that's released that is broken down by progesterone, binds to the GABA receptor within the brain. And so what happens is there's this drastic change in at the receptor level, and that there's that the GABA receptor is not being activated, and so people get these symptoms that are associated with postpartum depression. And so this drug works by working on the GABA receptor, and what's different about this is that it's taken daily for two weeks, and that people who in the trial were taking it found a significant improvement within a matter of days. And people who will know who are on antidepressants, that it can often take a couple of weeks for there to be any type of improvement that's seen. So this will revolutionize how postpartum depression will be managed. The issue will be, now that it's approved, is that what will be the cost? Because from my understanding, it's quite expensive.
Yeah, so it seems to be the issue with all kinds of drugs, especially the newer drugs. Malcolm, last week we were talking about that study that said that more men are being diagnosed at a stage four with prostate cancer. And you raised the issue of, what about cancers that are found that perhaps should not be treated? So since then, there was a big editorial in the New York Times asking the same question: should all those cancers be treated? And also an article from a doctor here saying we really should be pushing the PSA test, which a lot of people don't believe in for reasons that we discussed. So where do you stand on all of that?
Well, there's no simple answer to this. So the reality is that there are certain cancers that have that probably don't require treatment, or that the treatment that's required is unnecessary and potentially toxic and can also be difficult for patients. And the two best examples of that are thyroid cancer. So thyroid cancer, which is something we don't talk about very much, has a cure rate over 97%, and fewer than one Canadian a day dies of thyroid cancer. And some years ago, we saw this huge spike in diagnosis that was related to increased diagnostics, but there was no change in the overall mortality from the disease. So that raised the issue of the fact that with this particular test, we were discovering a lot of cancers that clearly did not need to be treated. It gets more complicated when you get to prostate cancer, because there's no question that, you know, it's said that anyone over 80 has prostate cancer if you, you know, biopsy the prostate and look at all of it very carefully.
Uh-oh, are we losing you? Malcolm?
I don't know.
Try again. Talk.
Talking. Is it off?
No, now we hear you again, so go ahead.
Sorry.
Try again. Okay.
How about now?
Yeah, now. Wait. Me? Go ahead.
Yeah, we're just for the audience, we are trying this new technology today. So so prostate's more complicated because over 5,000 Canadian men a year die of prostate cancer. So this is a very serious illness. But there's no question that some of the prostate cancers that are discovered probably don't need treatment, or the treatment, the morbidity of the treatment outweighs the risk of dying for cancer. The challenge with prostate cancer is it's very hard to tell which are the so-called good cancers and which are the bad cancers. And obviously, cancer is a frightening word. And if you're told you have cancer, most people are not super comfortable with an idea of, well, let's just follow it and we'll see you again in 6 months or a year. So I think what's happening is as our diagnostics improve, we are detecting more cancers, and this is going to change even more with that thing we talked about last week, which is this idea that you can now do these blood tests to detect small fractions of tumor DNA in the blood, which are even much more sensitive than ultrasound imaging, etc. So this is an ongoing challenge, but at the moment, we're really not there in terms of saying, this cancer doesn't need treatment, this cancer does need treatment. And in those circumstances, the tendency would be to treat.
Elisa, I mean, you and I have talked about patients who take some of these advanced diagnostics and they end up causing problems. But do you have patients coming for counseling about what to do prostate-wise?
So when a male will come in for their appointment for their preventative health exam, or just we're reviewing their overall health, we'll have a conversation in terms of if they want to do PSA testing. Some patients will come in and they will absolutely want to do it, and other patients don't have a desire. They feel that there's no family history and they don't want to do it. So it really becomes a discussion between myself and the patient in terms of how they would like to approach it. And I think because, well, as of now, there is no recommended screening that's been implemented by the government, that it really becomes a conversation, and patients need to understand this, that it's not recommended. But many men will go ahead and want to go ahead and do PSA testing.
Dr. Verma, what's your experience of this?
Yeah, I think my context, you know, I take care of people when they're in the hospital, and that's one source of a lot of this, where the medical term for this is called the incidentaloma, the idea that, you know, we're doing a CT scan of a chest or an abdomen for another cause, someone has an infection or some other issue, right? And then we see, oh, there happens to be a growth in a different area. It wasn't what we were looking for. And how do we manage that? And I think that's the context in which a lot of this comes on my radar. And I think to Malcolm's point, we've really improved our technologies in terms of their ability to detect lesions that may or may not be, you know, a problem. And we still need to then figure, which is great. Like, I think on the whole, that is a good thing. But the challenge is figuring out what needs to be treated. And there's a lot of work still to be done there. So that's the context in which I see it. And then as Elisa mentions, a lot of it is a conversation with the patient about whether or not depending on their other health issues and where they are mentally with thinking about their health, whether they want to pursue further diagnostics to work up things that were found as incidental findings.
Well, yeah, and we've also heard in terms of that communication problems where there were very serious incidental findings, but the patient wasn't told.
Yeah, it's really hard, exactly to that point. It's really hard to know if that spot that we see on an image is the one that's going to turn into a life-threatening condition or not, right? It's a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. Overall, there was one piece of, I guess, good news as we wrap things up, and that's that the family doctor shortage has, in fact, eased a bit in the last 3 years. Elise, I'm not sure that you are feeling that on the ground, but what's your reaction to that study?
You're 100%. We're not feeling it on the ground. It continues to be a challenge to navigate within the system for both me as a practitioner and for the patients. But you're totally right. Good news in that they're starting to show that across the country that more people are able to find a family doctor. The other thing that that study did point out was that people still aren't happy with in terms of access to care, and that there's still a significant improvement that could happen in terms of people being able to access timely care within 24 or 48 hours from your primary care practitioner. So hopefully as the system continues to improve and we hopefully get into more team-based care, that access will improve, because that's probably the most important thing from a patient perspective, and where a lot of frustration lies is that you want to be able to see the doctor who knows you and knows your history in a timely manner, and that creates a lot of frustration. So good news, and hopefully we'll continue to hear that investments into family medicine will continue to happen across the country.
Okay, well, I like to end our conversations on good news, so we will leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Elise Naiman, Dr. Amal Verma, and Dr. Malcolm Moore, and we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Excellent.
Bye. Bye now.
All righty. We are taking a break. And when we come back, well, phew, a pilot strike at Air Transat was averted, but there's still a lot of cancellations, a lot of people stranded. So we'll get the scoop on that. And what, if anything, we should learn from all of that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, many travelers are breathing a sigh of relief with just hours to go before a strike. Air Transat pilots came to an agreement, but today's canceled flights were still canceled and stranded passengers were still stranded. So to sort this out and to find out if there is anything we can learn from this little chapter, we've got Dr. Gabor Lukacs, who is the president of Air Passenger Rights, and John Graddock, a faculty lecturer at McGill University in Montreal and a former Air Canada executive. Hello, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Hi.
Okay, so making a deal as opposed to causing havoc, worsening the airline's financial position and annoying clients, that was probably a good choice for the pilots, John.
I think so. I think that the pilots basically kind of extended the negotiation sessions beyond what I think was required, but that's me. That's my personal opinion. I think that this deal could have been signed up days ago rather than just hours ago. And I think that, the union took it to Transat pretty hard, for the amount of money that the pilots are going to be getting out of this one. And I don't know the numbers exactly, but I know it's north of a 59% increase in salary over the next 5 years. It was pretty generous offer. I think that Transat put its financials at risk, the company at risk, in doing this type of deal and for the sake of getting a deal, for the sake of avoiding a strike. But time will tell whether this is a right decision and a right investment on the part of Transat.
I mean, I don't like to get into specifics necessarily of the ask and what they got, but what did they mean by a modern contract?
Yeah, the contract that they were having, it's just a 400-page contract, right? So it's got hundreds of clauses in there that have to get looked at. The contract was created in 2015 in the middle of an era where contracts were being imposed and or directed by the federal government to Air Canada, to WestJet, to anybody who would listen. That's why Air Canada got 10-year contracts for the flight attendants and for the pilots. And we all saw the outcome of that during this past summer's flight attendant strike, where that kind of blew up in everybody's face. So the contract with Air Transat's talking about was, again, another 2015 contract that did not have time to get renegotiated. Through time, they had the COVID they had to go through. They were in the middle of a buyout or a proposed buyout by Air Canada and then Pierre Carpelado back in 2021, 2022. So the contract, in terms of all the details, were never adjusted. So that contract was in 2015 on the non-monetary side is 10 years old. The monetary side, however, they've been getting increases, steady increases over the term of that since 2015. They've got about a 19% increase in salaries in the interim between 2015 and now, which is not a lot, but at least they got something compared to Air Canada pilots and WestJet pilots. But, you know, it is an old contract, and definitely that was a sticking point, and I agree with that one.
Okay, Gabor, so meantime, there were canceled flights. There are people, I mean, we've heard the stories, a woman trying to get to her cousin's wedding. That was kind of torpedoed, people with expensive hotel reservations. So what do you make of the damage that people are bearing because of this?
The greatest problem is that people are bearing some of the damages, even though the law says that Air Transat has to bear those damages. Under the law, given that the strike has not actually began, the pilots never walked off the job, any cancellation that happened was a cancellation within the carrier's control. That's what also the recent judgment of the Federal Court of Appeal from this past August indicates, that as long as the company has control of the labor force, has a control of its business, it is something you can do to avoid the cancellation, it's within the carrier's control. So under their passenger protection regulations, passengers should be receiving up to $1,000 in lump sum compensation. If their flight was canceled, it should have been rebooked or should be rebooked on Air Transat's own or competitor airlines at Air Transat's dime. Passengers who were forced to leave early, that's clearly wrong. Air Transat had no right under the law to force passengers to come home early. And passengers who missed out as a result on prepaid expense, say prepaid activities, going to a museum or a concert, or passengers who had lost wages as a result, are required to be compensated under the Montreal Convention, which is an international treaty that has a force of law in Canada. So to answer your question, yes, there are now passengers with lots of losses, but passengers should stand their ground and recover those losses from the airline through the court system if necessary.
And how long and how much of a hassle would that be?
Small claims court is the people's court. It depends on in which province you are, but it's not as complicated as a trial in a superior court in the province. It involves some hassle, yes, but I would suggest that passengers think about it as an investment. The reason that this keeps happening, the reason that airlines, and look at Air Canada in the past summer, they have also felt that they can get away with not following the law, not properly revoking passengers on competitor airlines. And the reason that it is happening is because people have not asserted their rights properly before. So we need to assert our rights today as an investment to our future as passengers, so that when the next strike happens, the next disruption happens, we get the rights that we are owed under the law.
What about the whole issue of, I mean, I know that for a lot of people, they've sort of scrimped and saved to try to get away. And the prospect of travel interruption insurance is just something they don't want to take on. It's expensive. It's usually, I think, around 10% of the total cost of the trip, but it also makes it a lot easier if stuff like this happens and you're out of pocket. It makes it a lot
That's
easier.
Incorrect. Pardon? That's actually incorrect.
Incorrect?
That's actually incorrect, yes, because travel interruption insurance typically covers a situation when you break a leg, and that's why you need to interrupt the travel, or if you have a family emergency at home and you need to fly home urgently before the end of your trip. Airline employee strikes are often excluded or just not even part of the risks that the insurance policy covers. I have not seen many insurance policies in my life that would cover flight cancellation delay as a result of a strike. But let's be clear again, travel interruption insurance is typically about when you need to interrupt it for reasons within your life, like a medical emergency, like something that's happening in your family.
So if you are buying travel interruption insurance, because some of it covered during the pandemic, some of it covered stuff that was happening as a result of the pandemic.
That's again incorrect. I'm sorry. That's not what was happening. Actually, as a matter of fact, insurance companies were refusing to cover those during the pandemic based on the fact that passengers receive vouchers. The insurance companies have enlarged en masse refusing to cover passengers. I do know that there's some insurance, travel insurance salespeople love to upsell their product and tell people that it's going to protect them. But unfortunately, the reality is very different. But
read the fine print. Read the fine print.
Is that John? Read the fine print? Because I know people who were able to collect compensation.
I would say it would be exceptional. There may be that some specific insurance policies had some language about it, but it's not common. It's highly uncommon because insurance companies don't want to expose themselves to the risk of a war breaking out somewhere or something truly uncalculable. That what you need to understand from insurance, and I'm talking also to someone from as a mathematician who taught some actuarial mathematics for insurance type of matters, is that insurance is about pooled risk.
Yeah.
And whether somebody is a given age, the given sex and given physical condition is going to have an illness that requires them to interrupt the travel, that's a calculable risk. There are big tables for it, big statistics for it, and there are actuarial experts, my former students, who can tell you how much you have to charge as a premium. When you deal with the risk of quite different nature, which is uncalculable, so vague, so rare events, so unpredictable, like an airline strike, insurance companies like to steer clear of that because it is a too high of a risk and too not just high, too unquantifiable for risk in many cases.
So, John, I'm going to give you the last word on this. The bottom line is if you're thinking of buying that insurance, read the fine print. But also, what do you say to people about going through the process to sue the airlines to, you know, as Gabor says, to protect their rights or carry them forward in the future?
The airlines don't like paying. Airlines do not like paying. We've seen this go since the dawn of the APPRs in 2019. This is it's an antithesis to their business model. They don't want to hear about it. They will drag their feet as long as they can, and they're going to let the courts, you know, drag money out of them in order to solve some of these issues. So I believe with Gabor, you know, the only way we're going to get them to pay attention is for them to basically have to have legal representation, whether it's at the provincial court level. CTA, useless. And we're sitting at 95,000 people in the backlog, so that's not working. So, you know, the courts are probably the best avenue if you want to really file a claim and believe that you have your rights being violated by the carrier.
And so again, like, what would you tell a close friend or family member if this happened to them? What would you tell them?
Get yourself a good lawyer.
Who works on contingency?
You need evidence. You need evidence. So every conversation you're going to have with the carrier, take a picture, record it, do everything. You know, every conversation is going to have to be part of the evidentiary trail that you're going to have to present in court. So you take videos, you take recordings, you take, you know, screenshots, whatever it is, record the trail, and that will be, you know, the stronger the trail, the better your chance of getting your compensation paid for.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Dr. Gabor Lukacs and John Graddick, thank you so much for shedding light on that. And let's hope that it's smooth flying and sailing for everybody who's planning a trip in the near future. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay. We're taking another break. And when we come back, wow. So Doug Ford, who has no trouble wading into municipal jurisdiction, well, he doesn't want to tell Toronto what to do about land transfer tax. I find this very interesting, and we'll get an early look at it with Karen Stintz when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we always save municipal issues for Thursday, but I couldn't wait when I heard the latest from the Ford government. And it's a red letter moment because Doug Ford says he doesn't want to meddle in a municipal responsibility. And he will not stand in Olivia Chow's way or try to stop her from raising land transfer tax on so-called luxury homes. Now, he also said the place to fight about this is at the ballot box. So is he trying to help her? Is he trying to hurt her? What's going on? So to try to sort this out, let us go to former city councillor Karen Stintz. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Libby.
So what did you make of this one when you heard it? Because I was wondering, what's he getting at? Is he tired of Olivia Chow or is he trying to help her out?
Well, you know, I think finally he is letting the municipality make its own decisions so that the municipality can be held accountable for those. You know, I feared that with the camera, even though I was in favor of the speed cameras, you know, I thought if people were really upset about the speed cameras in Toronto, then they really should make it an election issue at the ballot box for mayor. And I didn't think that that was something that the premier had to wade into. And now with Olivia Chow proposing to raise property taxes on the land transfer tax, it is appropriate that that is a decision that's made at City Hall. And I'm very, very grateful, although I oppose the matter, I'm very grateful that the premier is staying out of it.
Uh-huh. And there was this strange hybrid on the bike lanes where city council has now decided to spend millions more on new bike lanes that will not interfere with the lane of car traffic. And Prabhmeet Zakaria said, sure, no problem.
Yeah, no, and that's the way it should be. I mean, whether or not the city should spend millions creating bike lanes that may or may not get used is again, another matter. But I do think it's time that the provincial government stay out of the business of municipalities. And so I don't know if they're getting polling that's showing that people think that they've had enough of the premier wading into these matters, or whether they're just tired and focusing on other things because they actually should be focused on other things. I don't know, but I think it's a welcome development.
Uh-huh. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it politically, though. Is it a matter of, I mean, you'd think that they might wade in. They're kind of, I think, on the cusp of that Dave Pacini scandal getting bigger. So yeah, you would think they might want to distract us by actually wading in as opposed to backing off.
There is that, but the other reality is that if they say that we can't raise property taxes, then it begs the question, well, what will the province then do to help make us whole? And, you know, already they're giving us money now for speed enforcement matters, like ginormous signs that, you know, block site paths, but nonetheless. But, you know, every time they wade in, there's a cost that they now have to assume on behalf of the municipality. And, you know, I think that the government has rightly said, at this point, you know, we have bigger issues that we're trying to deal with, and we just can't be involved in these decisions anymore. And ultimately, the 2026 mayoral election is right around the corner, and that's when people will be able to make their voices heard.
What do you think is the state of the Ford-Chow relationship? They get along personally.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, they do.
Yeah. ideologically, I mean, is it good for Doug Ford to have somebody who is so much at the other end of the spectrum ensconced in Toronto?
You know, Libby, it's a weird one. You know, here's Premier Ford, who holds himself out to be a conservative, who has these love-ins with our Liberal Prime Minister and our NDP mayor. So, you know, I guess he's trying to present himself as a pragmatic man of the people, but it is curious nonetheless. And you know, I don't know what his logic is, or whether he actually has an opinion on the outcome of the next mayoral election.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some people who are saying this whole move is part of the mundanification of Toronto City Hall. Not that it needs mundanification. I think it's plenty woke, progressive, left-wing, all without any help from anyone from the outside. But it's also even the language that she used, I know that a lot of people find offensive, because there's, you know, a lot of people, especially older people, who suddenly find themselves with a house that's worth a lot of money, but it's not like, you know, they can barely afford the property taxes as they are now. And to hear Olivia Chow say, well, you rich people, you can afford it, and then mm-hmm. see what they waste their money on, like, it really sticks in people's craw.
Well, there's two conflicting messages coming out of City Hall. You know, one is that, and the province for that matter, one is that they want to build homes for people. And then, you know, City Hall takes that home and decides that it's a taxable asset. And that somehow we get punished for owning homes. And to your point, what's interesting is that these homes that have inflated over time and have become $3 million homes, they weren't $3 million homes when the family first purchased it, but now they're $3 million. And it's curious now who has to pay for that, because it's not the person selling the property, although the property might come down in price because of the new tax, but it's the new homeowner buying the property that is being punished because properties have been inflated over time. And so this over-reliance on land transfer is, I think, very, very problematic, particularly at a time when we're seeing a market slowdown. And although the projections are $124 million, I don't think that's going to be realized in this market. And I just also think it's dangerous rhetoric to continue to say, oh, well, because you live in this $3 million house, you can afford to pay more. We know that property tax is the most regressive taxation policy that we have. And so to rely on that as a way to provide free snacks is, I think, very problematic.
Well, yes. And I mean, not to mention the kinds of things that City Hall spends money on, some that we aren't even aware of. I mean, you know, I'm looking at Sankofa Square and they say, oh, it didn't come out of taxpayer money. Well, some of it does, for sure, for sure, for sure. Partly showing my age, real estate was like the subject of talk when we were first buying our houses for a long time. And I mean, it seems to be that a lot of Toronto's prosperity hinges mm-hmm. on real estate, and that may be changing right now. And is she on kind of the right side of that?
Well, it depends how you view home ownership. And so I'm still of the mindset, because I'm, you know, on the other side of 50, that, you know, home ownership has inherent value, that you vest yourself in a community, you make your home, your house, your home, you invest in it, you invest in the neighborhood. But if we create disincentives to home ownership because taxation rates are too high, well, then people will go towards the rental market, and there's nothing wrong with renting. And, you know, many places in Europe, that's the standard, but it's not what we're used to. So, I'm a bit reticent to suggest that that's the direction we should go through taxation, by taxing people out of their homes so they become renters. I don't think is a very good strategy for stable neighborhoods.
Yeah. So, is this something that can become an election issue, Or is it, you know, trying to pit so-called wealthier people against people who are less well off because they don't live in $3 million houses or they can't
Sorry to interrupt, but I do think it's an election issue and how it gets framed, because it all comes down to who pays and who benefits. And if there's a sense that we're paying for more than what we're benefiting from, and that cuts across many other demographics beyond those that own $3 million homes, then I think that that is an election issue. And this idea that home ownership should be taxed because you can afford a home, I think is a dangerous place for any mayor to go. And if that can become the ballot question, then I think that that does become a wedge issue in the next election.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. And again, we had the Toronto Real Estate Board asking the provincial government to weigh in. I would have thought that they'd have more clout than that, frankly.
Yeah, I would have, but I also think that the premier is recognizing the limits of his, you know, extension into municipal politics. And, you know, like, he's not the mayor of Toronto. And so with, at least with the speed cameras, he had some reach because it was a provincial policy. But, you know, in this case, the city council has the ability to tax, and the premier is understanding that that's within their purview. And ultimately, it's the mayor that will be held accountable.
Okay. Ultimately, it's the mayor that will be held accountable. And of course, we will drill down deeper on this and all kinds of other municipal issues tomorrow on Fight Back with our Tune Into the Town panel. In the meantime, thanks so much for an early chat on this, Karen Stintz.
Thanks, Libby.
Bye-bye.
We'll talk tomorrow.
Okay, that's all the time we have today for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and I will be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.